report is now out there. It's available online, and it's entitled The 2016 Edition of Metro Hartford Progress. And here to talk about that with us is Scott Gall, and he is the Community Indicators Project Director for the Hartford Foundation of Public Giving. Scott, welcome to Front and Center.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Scott, this is a very interesting report from several angles, but just as an overview, how do you view the report?
Well, it's like you described a minute ago, that we're looking not only at Hartford, but all of the towns around Hartford that are kind of economically, historically linked with Hartford, and we're trying to look at the big picture for the issues that affect that region as a whole. And the reason for doing that is that if I think this group of organizations doesn't kind of step forward to do that, those issues really have the potential to fall through the cracks. So there's a lot of things that are truly regional issues. They're not issues for individual towns. You look at things like transportation, workforce development, economic development. In our case, education is really truly a regional issue. And if you look at those things, that they're, you know, it's not sort of South Windsor's issue or Marlborough's issue or Hartford's issue. They're really issues for the whole region. Nobody's really going to step up and take a look at those issues unless we do sort of what we can to build relationships between organizations so that they kind of collaborate, work together voluntarily to make sure that we've got a basis of understanding for those issues. So like you said, we work with our organization, Hartford Foundation, the Community Foundation for the region, with the United Way, with the Council of Governments, with the Workforce Board, Capital Workforce Partners, with the Metro Hartford Alliance, with the Hispanic Health Council, the Urban League for Greater Hartford, and the City of Hartford, and Trinity Center for Urban and Global Studies, to really kind of step back, say what are the things that are regional issues, and where do we stand on them today, and what could we do to improve on those issues. So this is, we've done two rounds of it, and we just released the third round of this report this year.
Well, that's the big nut to crack, I guess. We live in a state made up of 169 municipalities that has a tendency to think parochially. In other words, they all think within the 169 municipalities. How do you get a region of 36 towns, essentially, to collaborate on certain areas?
Right. That's the, I don't know what dollar amount you would put on it, but that's a big question. And we have, you know, 300-400 year history of working in a different mode of operating. So I think we want to keep people's expectations realistic about this, but it starts with a couple of things, and we tried to outline that in the report this year. So we used a roadmap that someone had developed for kind of transformational change. One of the ingredients of that is kind of building a team and a coalition. So it's not going to happen through formal government mechanisms. It really has to happen through leadership and collaboration. Those are the two elements. And having these organizations, their leaders, their staff, kind of at least starting from the same baseline. So I think there's a quote that people use that people are entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. And so we're just trying to make sure that these organizations are at least starting kind of with the same facts that we're all using, and then hopefully using that as a basis to move forward to address those challenges. But you're right, it's a really big question. It goes very, that kind of collaboration across town lines is not something that's part of the culture here. And it's not necessary for everything, but we're looking at the things where there's issues or challenges that might fall through the cracks if somebody doesn't kind of raise them up and pay a little more attention to them.
You know what I found? There's so many interesting facets to this report, but one of the things I found interesting is that Harvard came down to do a study of the region in 1960 and essentially reached the same conclusion that the area could have more of an impact if it thought regionally rather than individually, Scott.
Right, and there's a very long history of those kinds of reports being generated. You know, every 10 years or so, there's sort of an initiative that steps back and does the same thing to kind of say, well, you know, what would we do to address these regional challenges? So there's this report from Harvard in the 1960s. There was an effort called Great Hartford Process in the 1970s. There was a town meeting of tomorrow where they brought together 500 leaders in the mid-60s as well. There was a Millennium Project around the turn of the century here. There's some efforts in the early 2000s. And so I think we're aware that we're part of this longer history of people, you know, trying to step back, take a look at these issues, Some of those things have had some modest successes, so I think there's good things you can take away from that, and then there's an understanding of, you know, what the obstacles are as well.
You know, there are so many, as I said, interesting facets, one of them being, and we'll just look at some of the highlights, and I urge people again to go online and read this report, because it's a great, great report. But one of the things which shows up, while school enrollment in the region declined by 7% since 2001, amounting to 29,000 additional empty seats in our region's classrooms, education expenditures have increased 25%. That was an eye-opener for me, Scott.
Right, and this is a good example of a couple things, hopefully. One, that should be a little alarming. I don't think anybody thinks that that's a great turn of events. And it's an illustration, a way to illustrate how some of the fragmented decision-making plays out. So I think people often think about what you described, that, you know, there's 169 towns and they kind of work in isolation. And sometimes it's hard to see, you know, why that's bad at all. You know, that doesn't strike me necessarily as that that's a bad thing. You know, it's nice to have, you know, neighborhoods and individual communities and lots of variation. So it's not like everybody has to do things the same way. But this is a good example of one instance where individual towns and districts plan for resources kind of in isolation. There's no obligation that, you know, town A and town B work together on planning for school construction or facilities. And so when in our case, the 38 towns in our region create those plans essentially in isolation from one another, we end up with a lot of something that you don't want. We have a lot of empty seats in classrooms in the region. Part of that's due to demographic shifts. Part of that's due to sort of the regional infrastructure for education. But a lot of it is due to just fragmented decision making. If people, you know, plan things together or thought about the future together rather than separately, we would probably have a better, more efficient use of resources. So to my mind, that's an example of where kind of the fragmented decision making process leads to a bad outcome that's pretty fixable. You know, there was a bill that got raised in the legislature last year about having sort of a regional check on some of this planning for education facilities. That's the kind of thing where it's not obligating people to do that much differently, but it's just saying, hey, take a step back, take a look at what the landscape for, you know, all of these towns in your vicinity are before, you know, we make these relatively large investments.
Talking with Scott Gall, Community Indicators Project Director for the Hartford Foundation of Public Giving, our guest here on Front and Center. And this report also focuses on the millennials. Who are they? How do they factor into the workforce? How about talking about that?
Right. This is one of the things that we had done, was look at, as a starting point, look at what do the nine organizations that we're working with care about. And a lot of those organizations really have a focus on, particularly essentially on a skilled workforce, but particularly on, you know, young people or millennials, or kind of however you want to call it. But that's something that they feel like there's going to be challenges as we have people aging out of the workforce. There's challenges kind of retaining people, keeping people in this region. We have a lot of great institutions of higher education, but how many of those people stick around, kind of invest in the community, find employment here? So this is something that's an area of focus for a lot of organizations, and I think we wanted to highlight two aspects of it. One part is that looking at millennials, they're not sort of a monolithic cohort. You know, all millennials are not like each other, that we've got a lot of diversity among millennials in the region. There's a lot of millennials who are living on fairly limited income. There's a lot of millennials who are living in, you know, parts of the region where there's a lot of challenges, where there's not great sort of access to opportunities like good schools or some of the things that, you know, most people consider part of what they're hoping for out of life. So that there are, among the millennials that are living in the region, there's a lot of diversity within that group. So that's one thing that we wanted to call out in the report. So one of the kind of headline stats that we have is that 43% of the millennials in the region live in a household that don't earn a family-sustaining wage, so that they're not earning enough money to support a family with kids based on, you know, the cost of living and the wages that they have in the region. So that's something that, you know, we want to think about what we're doing for that group and really all the different types of young people that live in this region. The other aspect that I think we wanted to focus on for millennials is really what does that group want? What are the drivers for young people when they choose where to live? And so the top driver for that group in making decisions about where to live across the country is jobs. You know, that's what the biggest driver for where people choose to live. That's when they're choosing between, you know, living in Hartford or Raleigh or Austin or wherever. Jobs is the main driver. Housing, family, other things, those play a role, but, you know, about 60% of people who move region to region cite jobs as the top factor behind that decision-making process.
I'll tell you what, there's so many things in this report, Scott. Here's another eye-opener for me. Most job openings in the future will be in either high-wage jobs that require advanced degrees, 27%, or low-skill jobs with wages that cannot sustain a family, 72%. That definitely should be an eye-opener for the region.
Hopefully that is. I mean, it's not great news, and what we want to do is at least just say, you know, here's what we know about what we're expecting for the future. So here's what the data says about job projections. Here's what we know about the wages. The future can change. That's where people can act to change the direction. But based on what we know today, this is what's projected to happen in the future. And that's a lot of people living at a level where it's hard to sustain a family. The United Way has had these ALICE reports, and they had one a couple years ago, and they're coming out with again soon, talking about kind of the working poor, people who are employed but don't have enough income in order to sustain themselves. And this is really looking at that that group that, you know, again, about three quarters of the job openings that we're expected to have in the future are jobs that are putting people in that working poor cohort.
You know what else I found interesting is we just see a changing of our demographics according to this report, and, you know, it's not anecdotal evidence. Many of the region's residents of all ages, not just the millennials, they want to be able to walk to shops, restaurants. Many of them want to live near where they work. What can you tell us about that?
Right. I think that's one of the other things we wanted to look at that I think is more positive for kind of the millennial population, but as you said, really all age groups. You know, if you ask, the easiest way to figure out what people want is just to ask them. And if you ask people the kind of place that they'd like to live, most of the time they say they want to live somewhere they could walk to shops and restaurants. If they live somewhere where they're car dependent, they want to move somewhere like that. If they live somewhere like that, they tend to want to stay there. That's the most frequently the case the younger you are, but it's really true, you know, for kind of boomer generation, for seniors, and so on. So that's something where it's positive because we're starting to get some of that development in the Hartford region. So a lot of it in Hartford, but also in some of the suburban towns around here that are connected, particularly those that are connected to the transportation network. So you're starting to see some of that, I think, probably in on the fast track corridor between Hartford and New Britain. We're going to see some of that along the commuter rail line that goes from Springfield in Massachusetts down to New Haven. There's an example in the report that we cited from Windsor Locks where they're really making an effort to make that downtown that kind of an area that people want to live in. They're taking a train station that's kind of in an isolated area near the highway, trying to move that downtown, be part of the historical town center where you have retail, shopping, housing, those kinds of things, so that it's a place that, you know, people would say, hey, you know, Windsor Locks, that sounds great, I'd like to live there. That's something where we're putting some of those pieces in place, you know, bit by bit throughout the region. But, you know, again, if you ask people where they want to live, they're pretty good at telling you the kind of place that they'd like to live. And so we're getting a little more of that in the region now. It's certainly something that could be expanded, but we wanted to highlight some of the infrastructure that's already being put in place.
And you can see, by the way, that it goes hand in hand with the sentiment as produced by the report of people who are spending money and time with long commutes, and that's money that could be in their pocket and time that they could be using for something else, Scott.
Right. This is, and we had done this a little more in the previous two reports to really try and call out some of the regional connections. So a fact from one of the first reports that I think struck people is the sort of what kind of an urban studies person would call a spatial mismatch that Hartford has, which is basically that people don't live where they work. So Hartford, there's about 110,000 jobs based in the city of Hartford. That's more than any other city in Connecticut. A little more than 80% of those are filled by suburban commuters, so people driving in who live somewhere else and then drive in to fill some of those 110,000 jobs in the city of Hartford every day. The reverse is also happening. So for the working population in Hartford, which is about 40, 50,000 people, two-thirds of those work outside the city of Hartford. So some of those people, for instance, are going out to Windsor Locks. They're going out to Manchester, to East Hartford, to jobs in suburban towns, and that's where that mismatch that people, you know, a lot of people in this region, which I think is fairly unique, do not live and work in the same place. I mean, that's true across the country, but it's more true in and around Hartford than a lot of other places. And that places a burden on commuters. That places a burden particularly on low-income commuters or people who are reliant on public transportation system. And that's why, you know, it's good that we're building some of this infrastructure out, but that's kind of one of the reasons behind it, I think, is to better link where people live and where people work within the region, or starting to look at, you know, some of the development of housing and those things around transit so that people can actually live closer to where they work, which, again, is, you know, when you ask them, that's kind of what they tell you.
Now, I know you touched upon it briefly earlier in the interview, but what needs to happen so that this report doesn't go up on a shelf and collect dust?
That's a really big question, and we have this timeline of history of all of the other kind of reports that have ended up largely ended up on shelves. You know, there's some successes from those efforts, but have largely gone on shelves. And so we're aware that there's a long history of that kind of thing happening and trying to do what we can to get around it. The roadmap at the end of the report sort of gives a few steps for this. The first step is creating urgency. That's what we hope this report does. We're just reporting the data kind of as it is. Unfortunately, a lot of that data should be kind of, as you'd said earlier, a little alarming. If that creates urgency, one of the next steps in this roadmap is trying to build a team of individuals, organizations. We hope that we have the elements of that with the 9 organizations that have been working on this. And then the next steps are really trying to work through that roadmap and see, you know, what are the areas that are of importance, removing some of the obstacles to progress in those areas and trying to kind of flesh out, you know, what the options are and getting some successes put on the books. So, again, there's a very long history of these kinds of efforts ending up on a shelf. I think the call for us is to do what we can to avoid that outcome. But it's a pretty powerful force.
And correct me on this, but if people want to access the report, they can go to metrohartfordprogresspoints.org. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
And through, you should be able to get it through any of the 9 partner organizations, so Hartford Foundation or the others that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. So, but the MetroHartfordProgressPoints.org is the site that houses the report and links to some of the other information in the previous reports, too, which, you know, give a little context for this year's.
Scott, thanks very much for illuminating this very important issue with our audience.
Thank you for the time and opportunity. And, you know, we really do hope to hear from some of your listeners if it's something that they heard that kind of piqued their interest or that they want to follow up on. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. You have a good weekend.
Thank you as well.
You're welcome.